from the very beginning of this study, I have tried to present to you a biblical case for the fact that the largely futuristic interpretation of the book of Revelation is way off base, and that for too long, Protestant evangelical Christians have not paid attention to the teachings of the Scriptures and paid more attention to prophecy mongers and people who have sort of made a living out of going boo to people and implying that the world is coming to an end in 2 or 3 weeks or by the year such and such, and that the history of Protestant evangelical biblical interpretation is the history of one failed prediction after another. But because people have such short memories, they forget that at one time everybody was convinced that Mussolini was the Antichrist, or the Pope is the Antichrist, or whatever the latest thing is. And so people who develop these false ideas and these failed notions are always given a pass, and whatever the current generation thinks is, you know, the end time expectation, well, that's what it is, and then that passes and the next person comes along. Nobody ever seems to want to really go back to the Scriptures and see what the Bible really, really teaches, and understanding these things in its context. We are not the first people in the 20th and 21st centuries to have read the words of the book of Revelation. They've been around for 2,000 years. And people with a lot more knowledge of Greek and Hebrew and biblical matters than any of us put together have disagreed and fought violent verbal arguments about how best to interpret these passages. And so I have said repeatedly that I think the best this side of heaven that we can hope to do is find an explanation for what these things mean that seems to be the most consistently biblical. Because I don't think absolute ironclad knowledge about the very controversial and very difficult passages of this book and some other parts of the Bible is possible. If it were, there would not be this continued disagreement over the years. And anybody who tries to pawn off on you the idea that unless you agree with their particular view of Bible prophecy, you're not a Christian, or you're going to hell, or you're working for the devil, or whatever it is, they ought to be ashamed of themselves, and you shouldn't pay any more attention to them. Because it's only people who can't see beyond the rantings and ravings of the prophecy mongers who would ever take such a point of view. Because when you actually start studying the history of biblical interpretation, you come to find out that very, very serious scholars who love the Lord, they believe the Bible is the infallible and errant word of God, have disagreed on these matters, and disagreed profoundly, and disagreed in some strikingly contrary ways, as we have been seeing, and as I'll especially mention today. So, the point of view that we have adopted and have been taking in this class, as we have found it to be presented in Scripture, is that largely, for the most part, and you see these are kind of weasel words, and that's for a reason, the prophecies mentioned in the book of Revelation have taken place already. And that they are focused primarily on the destruction of the temple of the Jews in AD 70. And when it talks about the end times and the last days, it's the end times and the last days of the Old Covenant Jewish administration. That's what was coming to an end in that generation, as Jesus said in Matthew 24. Not the end of the world. And when we come to Revelation 20, as we did the last time we met, this is where we start to see things start to sort of get a little bit shaky. Because here we find that even people who take a past fulfillment view, this is where the disagreements start to come in, and that's why I've listed the things that I've listed on the board that I'll be referring to here in just a moment. because the question is, once you really start to see the biblical value of understanding things in this way, the question naturally arises, well, is all of it fulfilled? I mean, obviously, what most people would understand the, quote, second coming of Christ to be, that didn't take place in the past. So you've either got to understand that the second coming of Christ, quote, unquote, as we have always understood it, at least the way we think we've always understood it, let's be more specific, the way it's been understood for about the past 150 or 200 years in Protestant evangelicalism. And let me remind you that the past 250 years in Protestant evangelicalism is nothing compared to the 2,000 years of church history. And people who think that nobody had read and understood the Bible prior to Scofield or Billy Graham are sadly mistaken. I hope this doesn't come as a shock to anybody, but maybe it does. I don't know. And so when we come to this, we have this area where we have to confront this issue. Okay, maybe it's obvious that this part was fulfilled in that time period from roughly the time of the resurrection to the time of the destruction of the temple. But what about this part? And what about that part? And so we come now to these perspectives. As I've mentioned to you before, the past fulfillment view, the technical theological term for it, is preterist, from the Latin meaning past. Just as futurist means future. And there are four different, to recover some ground we've already covered, there are four different views about how to interpret New Testament prophecy. There is the preterist, which says it's all or partially in the past. There is the futurist that says it's all or mostly in the future. It hasn't happened yet. There is what's called the idealist point of view, which says that when we read things in the book of Revelation, those things are not meant to be taken literally, but are primarily symbolic things meant to talk about moral issues that the church confronts throughout its history. So the main thrust of the book of Revelation from the idealist standpoint is, as long as the church exists on this earth, there will be struggle, there will be suffering, but Christ will triumph in the end. And they don't spend a lot of time trying to decipher how this applies here and that sort of thing. Or if they do, it's all sort of reduced down to a moral application. And then there is the historicist point of view, which we've talked about in this class before. And the historicist point of view was very popular among many of the Protestant reformers. And the historicist point of view is an interesting blend of several of these others, in that the historicist looks at the book of Revelation as a prophecy of the unfolding of the history of the church. So it's futurist in that sense. But they actually think that what you can see in the various segments and chapters of the book is a prediction of what will happen to the church. So they say, you can see here in Revelation, say, I'm not being specific here, this isn't accurate, but this is a general example of how the historicist interpretation works. You can see in Revelation chapters 3, 4, and 5, the history of the church from roughly A.D. 400 to A.D. 700. And then when you get to chapter 6 and 7, you go from A.D. 800 to about A.D. 1200, that sort of thing. And when you see the swarm of locusts, well, that refers to the Saracens, the Turks, as they dominated Europe, the Muslim invasions of Europe. And so they see all these literal historical events prophesied and having taken place. And another thing that is fairly typical of the historicist point of view is their view of the Antichrist. The Antichrist, as I believe from the preterist standpoint, was not someone they say who existed in the past, or that they don't agree with the futurist, that it will be some future world leader like a Jew who will deceive Israel and however else it's conceived, but rather the Antichrist is the Pope. The papacy, the institution of the papacy, is the Antichrist mentioned in Scripture. So you've got those four positions that have been held variously throughout the history of the church. But among the preterists, you have four different positions that have come into being just in the past 100 years or so. You have the classical position, which we'll be talking about today, at least as far as we understand Revelation chapter 20. You have what's called the neo-preterist, the partial preterist, and the hyper-preterist. And as we come to the conclusion of this series of lectures, I'm going to be expounding a little bit on each one of those. But I want to move right into the classical preterist interpretation of Revelation 20, verses 1 through 10. In his monumental work, The Parousia, and this is a copy of it, several of you have read this book or have copies of it, J. Stuart Russell's The Parousia, he articulates what I have classified as the classical preterist view. And it's so classified because Russell, while certainly not the first expositor or scholar to have argued for a past fulfillment view of much or all of the New Testament prophetic events, or at least for the book of Revelation, he was the first to have systematically and thoroughly presented that view in modern times. This book, The Parousia, this edition is one of several reprints that have been done just in the past 4 or 5 years. This edition was published in 1999 by Baker Books. It has a preface by Dr. R.C. Sproul. There's a new edition out with that same preface. The book was originally published in 1878 in England. J. Stuart Russell was a Bible scholar of the Congregational Church, and I think you might find it of some interest, if I can find the paper I had here, to see some of the comments that the book garnered when it was first published. I contacted one of the librarians at my alma mater, Westminster Theological Seminary, and they had an early edition of the book in the library. And in the early edition, or excuse me, the second edition, there are some comments, sort of a book review made, by several well-known Bible scholars in England at the time. Now, again, what to kind of put this in context for you, what Russell has done in this book is he starts with the Gospels, and he goes right through the book of Revelation in the New Testament and makes what I think is pretty much an ironclad biblical case for the fact that the prophetic statements we read in every area of the New Testament, with one exception, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, have already been fulfilled. And as you can imagine, you might think, well, this must have been highly controversial. Now, Russell earned a doctor's degree from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. No mean institution. He was a first-rate scholar. How many of you have read this book or read parts of it? Okay, three or four. Just the size of it may appear daunting, but he writes in a very scholarly but, how would you say, easy reading, I think, kind of style. It's not a hard read. And I think if you would get hold of a copy of this and once you start in it, it's hard to put it down. But listen to the comments that were made by some of his peers in biblical scholarship and pastoral ministry. Austin Farrar, who's one of the great Bible commentators of the 19th century and early 20th century, he says, "I borrow this ingenious suggestion from the author of the Parousia, a book full of suggestiveness." Hardly a condemnation of heresy, which I think many people would be quick to assume. The late Reverend P.S. Dupré, "I have taken the liberty of sending you a few remarks on what I consider the grand mistake of your wonderful book. It is simply impossible with me that I should accept your theory respecting Babylon. However, I might wish that it were true. Nothing would be more delightful than, by endorsing your views, to be able to prove that the eschatological predictions of our Lord had a veritable accomplishment. I am so persuaded that you have nothing but the truth in view that I'm sure you will give my arguments due consideration." Now, he didn't agree with what Russell said, but he obviously respected the man's scholarship. The British Quarterly Review, "A careful and reverent inquiry into the meaning of our Lord's second coming as predicted so largely and in such manifold forms the New Testament. Nothing can be more reverent, scholarly, or thorough than the author's treatment of the different passages than his criticisms on their various interpreters. His volume deserves very careful study of all students of eschatology." And then this one. Now, this one will really surprise you when I tell you who wrote it. Quote, "Though the author's theory is carried too far, it has so much of truth in it and throws so much new light upon obscure portions of the scriptures and is accompanied with so much critical research and close reasoning that it can be injurious to no one but may be profitable to all." Charles Spurgeon wrote those words. All right, so this book has had a long and distinguished history, therefore. And so I'm calling it the classical view because prior to the republication of his book, no one had really articulated this view in quite this way. And again, let me say that when we start to trace back throughout church history and we try to define, did somebody 500 years ago have this view? Or did somebody 1,000 years ago have this view? It's hard to nail that down, whether you're talking about dispensational premillennialism or any of these others, because there are little bits and pieces of all these views in the various writers. For example, there are people who want to claim that Luther and Calvin were of the historicist position because they believed the Pope was the Antichrist, which they did. But that's as far as it went with them. They took a much different view of how to interpret Revelation than the historicists did. So when you start going back into church history, these boundary lines start to blur a little bit. But what's most notable about Russell's exposition of Revelation 20 is his belief that this is the one place in the book of Revelation, which or where reference is made to a future yet to be fulfilled event. And noting how some authors interpret the millennial reference to make it fit within their prescribed interpretive framework, Russell states, and I quote him, "Some interpreters indeed attempt to get over the interpretive difficulties of Revelation 20 by supposing that the 1,000 years, being a symbolic number, may represent a period of very short duration and so bring the whole within the prescribed apocalyptic limits. But this method of interpretation appears to us so violent and unnatural that we cannot hesitate to reject it. The term of the dragon's imprisonment is distinctly stated to be for 1,000 years, and this must necessarily pass entirely before the field of vision so strictly and constantly limited by the book itself." Now, what's so striking about that statement, for anyone reading Russell's work straight through, is that to this point, he has found virtually no prophetic statements in the New Testament that were not fulfilled prior to the close of the Jewish age with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And yet, here in these verses, he is willing to part with what to that point had been a consistently held view of past fulfillment and argue for a futurist understanding of certain parts of Revelation 20. And he affirms as much where he writes, and I quote him again, "We believe, however, that this portion of Revelation 20 is the solitary example which the whole book contains of this excursion beyond the limits of shortly or soon to come to pass. And we agree with Moses Stuart that no reasonable difficulty can be made on account of this single exception." Now, Moses Stuart is another one who holds this classical preterist point of view. This is volume 2 of his 2-volume commentary on the book of Revelation. Moses Stuart was a Calvinistic Congregationalist pastor and theologian. He taught at Andover Seminary over in Massachusetts. This book was originally published in 1845. This is a reprint, obviously. So he was writing in 1845, even before Stuart Russell wrote his book. So here is another Protestant evangelical scholar of the 19th century who was advocating this point of view. Now, then Russell proceeds to analyze the several elements of this passage by making an important distinction between the author of the book of Revelation, and we'll say it's the Apostle John, between what he sees as the prophetic statements and the visionary statements. Russell says that when we get to this part, we see something very interesting starting to happen. You've got certain things that he sees that are visionary, and then you've got him making, I guess, what he might call non-visionary prophetic statements. He maintains specifically that verses 5 to 10 of chapter 20 are of a different character than the rest of the verses, and that they interrupt the flow of the narrative. The narrative which he maintains is resumed at verse 11. Let's look at that just a minute. When you start to understand what he's talking about here, you really can see this to a certain extent. He starts off, "Then I saw an angel coming down." Verse 4, "Then I saw thrones." And you notice at verse 5, he throws in, "The rest of the dead did not come to life," and he goes on like this. And then you notice verse 11, what does it say? "Then I saw." So what Russell is saying is that from verse 5 to verse 9, you don't have that "then I saw, then I saw, then I saw." That verses 5 to 9 are sort of a parenthesis in which he's sort of explaining something. He's talking in a different way than he was previously. Now, Russell begins his analysis by pointing out that divine justice demands that if those who practice wickedness are to be punished, so too must be the instigator and author of all wickedness. And accordingly, chapter 20 here presents a picture of the dragon being bound and thrown into the abyss for 1,000 years. And Russell notes that this part of the chapter, as we have just said, is distinguished by these words, "and I saw." And this, he writes, is of the genre of apocalyptic vision, and that what is seen therein is an integral part of the larger project of the parousia. Russell believes that this event is past and it can easily be located along with the rest, or excuse me, along with most all of the other events of the apocalypse in the era of the closing down of the Jewish age. He argues for this in light of the following. First of all, the language of the dragon's binding and imprisonment is obviously symbolic and figurative. It refers, therefore, to a large-scale curtailing of demonic or satanic activity during a specific time frame. And while the times before and during the earthly ministry of Jesus were those that were characterized by large-scale demonic activity and moral wickedness and spiritual darkness on a massive scale, the times since the works of Christ have been characterized by a lessening or a crippling of those things. Secondly, the worship of pagan idols, everywhere present and pervasive in the ancient world and practiced for thousands of years, has, by comparison, Russell argues, almost totally disappeared in the gospel age. And this is due totally to Christian influence throughout the world. And we're talking about obvious, what we might call rank idol worship. Anybody here been to another country where they literally worship idols? I mean, it's pretty obvious. You don't see that. And at one time, if you could be transported back to pre-Christian areas of Germany or Scotland or England, you would see that going on. Now, you know, we can debate all day long whether or not the Roman Catholics worship idols and all that sort of thing. I don't want to get into that discussion. But the point is that kind of paganism and idol worship that you still see going on in places like India and other places where you have animistic type religions, you don't see that as pervasive as you once did in those parts of the world where they existed prior to the coming of Christ. Thirdly, Christ declared, and let's look at this. Turn to the Gospel of Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. This is the story of Christ sending the 72 disciples out. I'm reading from the ESV, the English Standard Version, beginning of verse 17. Then the 72 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Behold, I've given you authority to tread over serpents and scorpions, etc., etc. So Christ declares in Luke 10:18 that he's beholding the casting out of Satan. And then turn over to the Gospel of John, the Gospel of John, chapter 12. John chapter 12. And notice what he says in verse 31. John 12:31. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. A clear reference to the contemporary, at that time, striking down of Satan's power. The Lord clearly states that now, then, not in the year 2015, but then, when he was speaking, Satan is cast out of the world. And now these passages, Russell believes, along with a few others, are all indicators that in and through the works of Christ, satanic influence is being curtailed and marginalized. Most importantly, this is one of these things that because of the way we've had the sort of late great planet Earth left behind blinders on, we don't think about this as we should. From a biblical standpoint, most importantly, with the removal of the temple at Jerusalem and the removal of Judaistic influence over the church, and I mean that in the negative sense. I mean in the sense of, you know, the Pharisaical laws. There's some Judaistic influence that I wish that we had maintained, frankly. And if you were here for Pastor Slissel's presentation a few weeks ago, you heard some very important things about that. But with the removal of all that, the most significant obstacle to the spread of the gospel was removed with them. So then, the binding of Satan and the removal of his large-scale influence are events that go hand-in-hand with the end of the age and the end of the only age that was of primary concern to the author of the book of Revelation, the Old Covenant age. Now, for Russell, This is not to claim that all sin and all evil has disappeared or will disappear. Rather, it means that the tide of human wickedness, at flood levels in all ages prior to the coming of Christ, was now in serious recension. And since this is designated symbolically as something that occurs over a 1,000-year period, it must be construed to be a long but indefinite span of time. Most importantly, since this information comes by means of apocalyptic visions, such large rounded numbers, the 144,000, 1,000, are to be understood in that context, not as historical markers of specific chronological time, but as a symbolic number, as we have seen on other occasions where that number 1,000 is clearly meant to be symbolic. Now, in his analysis of verses 4 through 6, Russell notes that this section, like its predecessor, it begins with, "And I saw," thus placing it within the time period as the other apocalyptic events and in the personal observation of the author of the book of Revelation. Now, Russell links the events of this part of the vision with the statement of Jesus to his disciples in Matthew 19, 28. I want you to turn to that passage. Matthew 19, verse 28. And by the way, before we look at this, let me ask you a question. We'll talk about this in more detail when we go into the neo-preterist perspective, which we won't get to today. Let me ask you something. What does Revelation say is happening to Satan here? From using the symbolic language of physical activity, excuse me, he's being bound. Now, again, this is something we're not understanding as a literal, like I would get some rope and bind Bob DeMeo over here. You can't do that to Satan. He's a spiritual being. But here's the thing to think about. Is this the first and only place we read of in the Bible about the binding of Satan? Is it? Where else do we read about it? Jesus in the parable of binding the strong man. And he clearly says in that parable that that was something he was doing. It was something taking place as a part of his earthly ministry. But now here in Matthew 19, 28, we read, "So Jesus said to them, assuredly I say to you that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Now what do we see happening in Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6? We see this judging, these people, these thrones, and the judgment taking place. Is there anything in Jesus' statement that would have led those people to believe that what he just told them was something that would be happening in the year 2012? No. It's something that they were led to believe by him to expect as a part of his ministry and in the regeneration when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory. Well, when does Jesus do that? I mean, is Jesus over walking around in Troy right now waiting to assume his throne of glory? No. He's already on that throne of glory. How do we know that? Well, the Bible tells us that. Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6 portrays then the fulfillment of that promise. And furthermore, the larger redemptive historical meaning in the events of AD 66 to 70 are therefore interpreted to mean that the time had then arrived, the time of the judgment upon the foes, the enemies of the gospel, the enemies of the Messiah. Now, Russell believes that the rest of the dead mentioned in the verse may only be one of three possibilities. Either they're the righteous dead, either they're the wicked dead, or there's some combination thereof. And in his opinion, the best option is that the rest of the dead are the wicked or unrighteous dead, though he admits that that view is not without its difficulties. And let me say again, there is absolutely no presentation of any interpretation of the book of Revelation and Bible prophecy that is not without its interpretive difficulties. I say to you now what I said at the beginning, and I've said 100 times since we started this, your challenge is to find the one that seems to be the most consistently biblical and has the fewest number of interpretive difficulties. I think that's the best we can hope for, this side of heaven. And seeing black helicopters for locusts and nuclear bombs and all that other stuff, I think, is much more difficult to defend than what we're talking about here. In this view, then, the first resurrection includes only those who have died in Christ, and specifically points out to the reader that all those who have a part in that resurrection are not said to be reigning, are now said to be reigning with Christ on the earth. They are now said to be reigning with Christ, not reigning with him on the earth. Okay? So this is not Jesus coming back and setting up his ministry in the temple at Jerusalem and the saints have come with him. It doesn't say that. You have to do some pretty serious hermeneutical yoga to make it say that. Rather, they live and reign with him where he is. And as Russell next considers verses 7 to 10, it's here that he sees a major shift in the content of the material of the apocalypse. Let's look at the verses. I'm reading from the King James Version. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. And notice, this doesn't say, and I saw. This is sort of, again, Russell says, this is sort of an inspired commentary about the vision that he's just seen. You can see, in your mind, put a parenthesis around this. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, and gather them together to battle, the number of whom is of the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. Here the author is writing in terms, the author of Revelation, Russell says, is writing in terms of direct prophecy as opposed to apocalyptic vision. And what is recorded here comes not as a visionary experience before his eyes, but rather a prophetic prediction or a declaration of this is what's going to happen. According to Russell, the language and content of these verses place them outside the apocalyptic limits, as he calls it, of that time period between roughly 30 and 70 AD. Those things that, as we have seen, clearly the Bible teaches were to, at that time, have been shortly or immediately or soon to have taken place. Quoting Russell again, it would have been an abuse of language to say that events at the distance of 1,000 years were to come to pass shortly. We are therefore compelled to regard this prediction as laying aside the apocalyptic limits altogether. There is this section and this alone in the book of Revelation that is still future and unfulfilled in his view. And Russell notes that there is nothing in recorded history that in any way would lead one to conclude that these verses describe something fulfilled in the past. As stated above, verses 5 to 10 are a sort of special insert, or 7 to 10 at any rate, or a parenthesis meant by the author of the Apocalypse to function as a concluding statement about the ultimate fate of Satan. All right, so he's saying that you've got this symbolic reference of the number, but when we come to this part, there's no symbolism here, except in the sense that we're dealing with a long span of time and it hasn't happened yet. Now, I want to just launch into the next position because, you see, the point of view that most people who have embraced and have come to understand or recapture this time-honored point of view about the book of Revelation, people like R.C. Sproul, Ken Gentry, they hold what's called the partial preterist view, and we'll talk more about that as we go along. But there are people who have read J. Stuart Russell, and they have said, well, I don't think, I think he's gone too far, as you heard some of those comments say, and R.C. Sproul was one who read J. Stuart Russell's book and said that, but having said that, he said, I think we need to pay very much attention to what this man is saying. But now there's another group of people that read his book, or even books other than his that I haven't mentioned to you, and they've said, he hasn't gone far enough. And because he sees this little area here in Revelation 20 that is still future, they say, he's backing away from what to this point had been a consistently biblical application of these principles. And so they part company with him, just as the partial preterists say he goes too far, and he's absorbing too much in the past fulfillment view. the neo-preterists and their close cousins, the hyper-preterists, and I'll make a distinction between these two as we go along, they say he hasn't gone far enough, that he's still holding on to some future fulfillment that he really shouldn't be holding on to. Now, that view is a recent variation, and I say recent within the past 30 years or 40 years, 30 years really, a recent variation of the classical preterist view. And it departs, this neo-preterist view, departs from the classical view most significantly in its assertion that all prophetic references in the New Testament have been fulfilled. Probably the most famous person who advocated this point of view and the one who influenced people the most was Church of Christ minister and scholar Max King in his monumental work, The Cross and the Parousia of Christ. 800 pages of really, really striking analysis of the subject of the meaning of the cross. And his work has influenced a number of other, probably more popular, neo-preterist writers. And for the neo-preterist, the key concern, and this is where I'm going to leave it because the next time I'll flesh this out, we don't have time to go into it now. The key concern and the starting point for properly understanding the difficult material in this first section of Revelation 20 is this. Does the author of the book of Revelation stand at the beginning of the millennial age, anticipating its arrival and its transition and its ultimate consummation at some point in the future? Or does the author stand somewhere, and I mean stand in a chronological sense, in the latter stages of the millennial age, and he's primarily concerned with anticipating its consummation? And so what they're going to come off arguing is that far from something that has to go into the distant future for any aspect to be fulfilled, that the millennium, from their point of view, is... is you've got this time frame from AD 30 to AD 70, and that is the millennial age. That 40-year span is the millennium. And we'll see why they argue that next time.